Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Martin Cruz Smith, who reads from and discusses his new book, Stalin's Ghost, published by Simon & Schuster. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore, and thank you for silencing your cell phones. Though he's perhaps best known for the classic Gorky Park, Martin Cruz Smith clearly has more than one trick up his sleeve. With his novels even more popular since the end of the Cold War, his research sets his work apart. In Stalin's Ghost, aside from dealing with reports from subway riders about seeing the ghost of Joseph Stalin, Renko must confront the ghost of his own father, a favorite general of Stalin's. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to the author of Stalin's Ghost, Martin Cruz Smith.
Yes, can the lady in the back here? Yeah. Actually, that lady came with me. And she's, I bring her along for sound testing. So I'll read a little bit, and then the part I like most is the question and answer, because it's new to me. You know, you're going to say something, you're going to ask a question that I don't have the answer to, and then I'll have to sort of rummage around my brain and either come up with nothing or something that'll surprise me, something intelligent. This is the sixth book of with Arkady Renko, and I never intended to do more than one. But then Russia kept changing, so it's I found myself anyway doing a chronicle of Russia as it's changed. And of course, what interested me most recently was this phenomena of the nostalgia for Joseph Stalin. Here's a man who was responsible for the death of 20 million of his countrymen, starved 7 to 8 million Ukrainians to death, which had got a daily list of names, thousands of names, people who had been denounced, or people who just whose luck had run out, and he would check them off, and 5,000 from one city, 10,000 from another. And, of course, the eager cadres in those cities would try to overfulfill the quota. So it's a ghastly record, and I don't think there was another bloodier despot in history, not Tamerlane, not Genghis Khan. So explain to me why this man has a 53% approval rating in Russia. There are some reasons. One of them has to do with the loss of the empire, the humiliation of the collapse of the Soviet Union, the idea that they first were sort of, that Gorbachev weakly let these countries, parts of the Soviet Union, drift away, that Yeltsin, after being a hero, then became a drunken buffoon, and I mean, we all remember the time when Boris Yeltsin landed in Ireland to meet the Irish president, and couldn't get off the plane, and there was the president of Ireland standing in the tarmac, and Yeltsin was incapacitated. It was a comic and pathetic scene, and that's sort of what has happened until Vladimir Putin, who this in a cold blooded way has seized power. Not only elected president, but has dismissed some 20-some governors of the regions of the Soviet Union. Now he's going to appoint them himself. So he is a very interesting man. He's called by some Stalin Light. At the very least, we see that there's a sort of that democracy has been tried and found wanting by the Russians. They prefer an authoritarian or firm hand at the tiller. And there's something else that I found really interesting. And what I do is, of course, I think the obvious, and then I ask the Russians, my Russian friends, something about, and they tell me something a little bit more nuanced and more interesting, which is that during the purges and the slaughter and the mayhem and the arrests, the nightly disappearance of people, it was also the period of idealism, the most idealism. And this is, to me, particularly Russian, this contradictory slaughter, fake trials, and idealism, this belief in this Soviet society and in communism. And at that point, during those days, they regarded themselves as a classless society. It was a system of perks. It was a system in which you got a better vacation. You got 2 weeks at a spa, at a sanatorium. Your son or daughter would be able to go to the university. You would get a better ration. You were allowed to have lunch at a better cafeteria. You were allowed to have, perhaps even miraculously, a car. And now they look around and they see what they regard as a class society. And for them, the top class is made up of a pack of thieves. It's an interesting sort of a point that they made, one that I had missed entirely, but humiliation has proved to be powerful fuel. Now I'm going to read something that I don't know quite how that little talk leads into this, because this is fun. Because if you're going to have Joseph Stalin come back and haunt you, I think that you've got to do something a little unexpected. Now, you bear with me if my mouth goes so dry that my tongue adheres to my soft palate. This is a scene at party headquarters. I went to the party headquarters, and it was a little bit like lifting a rock and seeing some toads. These were not the people who protest against the loss of communism. The little old ladies, the babushkas, who are freezing out there in Red Square, demonstrating against the government, against the big money, against the shysters. These are the original. These are the last rats on the ship. And of course, visiting them was a very unusual scene. It wasn't scary in the least. It was like any office, and the worst threat was a paper cut. But you could see in them in these characters who were beefing up and down the hall, that the same old taste for power that they had so recently lost. So here we are at party headquarters, and we have Arkady, an investigator. We have Tanya, an enigmatically beautiful woman. Why not? Platonov, a Soviet grandmaster in chess, man in his 70s, and Surkov, a propagandist for the party. This is always like lining up for a high dive. By the time Arkady had returned to party headquarters, the celebration had dwindled down to Platonov, the propagandist Surkov, and Tanya. Why she had stayed wasn't clear, although it was obvious that Surkov was desperate to impress. And the group had squeezed into his office so that he could show off his 4 phones, 3 televisions, and all the remote controls that a media-wise professional would need. A laptop on the desk emitted an azure glow. The walls were covered with photos of past Soviet glory. The Russian flag lifted to the roof of the Reichstag. A cosmonaut in the space station mirror. A mountain climber exulting on Everest. But everyone's attention was fixed on a white uniformed tunic that Surkov lifted out of a wooden crate stamped Classified Archives of the CPSU. His uniform, Surkov opened the tunic and hung it over the back of a chair facing the laptop. The cloth was yellow along the fold lines and gave off a faint scent of camphor. His personal effects. Surkov laid out an antique sewing kit, a snapshot of a freckled girl in an oval frame, a velvet pouch that yielded a briar pipe with a cracked bowl. He tapped the laptop's cursor pad. His favorite film. On the screen, Tarzan swung in a jungle vine and sent out a wild ululating call. "We know the human Stalin," Surkov said. Spencer Tracy and Clark Gable, those were Stalin's favorites. And Charlie Chaplin. Stalin had a wonderful sense of humor. Critics say that Stalin was an enemy of creative artists. Nothing could be further from the truth. Writers, composers, and filmmakers deluged him with requests for his opinion. "Please read my manuscript, Comrade Stalin. And look at my painting, beloved comrade." His analysis was always on the mark. "But no kissing," said Tanya. Surkov recoiled. Soviet films like The Jolly Guys and Volga, Volga, Volga didn't need sex. Certain quarters rail against Stalin because they want Russia to fall apart. He's the symbol they attack because he built the Soviet Union, defeated fascist Germany, and made a poor country into a superpower. Granted, some innocent people suffered, but Russia saved the world. Now we have to save Russia. Things were getting a bit rich for Arkady. "Wait," Surkov said. "Being who you are, I have something here that you might appreciate, something very special." On his desk, the propaganda chief set a gramophone with black enameling, a felt turntable, and an arm and horn decorated in silver arabesques. From a record album with no title, notes, or credits, he slipped out a stiff and heavy 78 RPM disc. He handled the record on its edge with his fingertips and let it settle on the spindle. "A pressing of one, not for release to the general public," Surkov set the needle in a groove. The acoustics of the office seemed to expand and tap into another room with its nervous coughs, shuffling feet, and stage fright. Finally, a piano picked out a tune. "Beria on piano," Surkov said. Beria, who had signed death orders for perhaps millions of his countrymen as head of state security, was tentative at first, but gained confidence as he played. "Faster," someone ordered, and Beria immediately picked up the tempo. Tanya was surprised. "I know this. It's T for two." Beria was also quite the dancer, Surkov said. And he took Tanya's hand and took her out to dance. She shrugged and let him drag her into a seesaw sort of polka around the desk. Platonov watched wistfully, missing a playmate his own age. "How well do you know her?" Arkady asked. "Not a bit, but a pretty woman always dresses up a place." The needle hissed. A hymn followed, and Tanya released herself with an audible sigh. Hymns of the Russian Orthodox Church were a slow blending of voices, repetitive and hypnotic. But Arkady wondered who was in such a butcher's choir. Tanya asked, "Communists singing hymns?" Platonov said, "In the war, everyone prayed, atheists included." The hymn gave way to a single voice, singing, "I searched for the grave of my beloved while grief tore at my heart. The heart aches when love is gone. Where are you, Suliko?" And Surkov mouthed, "It's him." Stalin's everyday voice was as dry and ironic as a hangman's. Singing brought out a pleasant tenor and a sentimental feel for melody. It was a solo, just Stalin and the piano, with Beria, presumably back at the keyboard. The great leader had a Georgian accent, but the song was Georgian. It was a classic. A forlorn lover discovers the girl that he seeks has been transformed by death. When he calls, "Are you there, my Suliko?" a nightingale answers, "Yes." Surkov said, "He could be standing here with us. He sounds that close." "It was definitely time to go," Arkady said. I hope somebody was offended. I'll find somebody who's offended by this nasty treatment, cursory treatment of our beloved comrade. But it taps in. It's sort of we have to remember that he was the world. He was the sun. And when he died, convicts in the Gulag Archipelago, political prisoners by the million, cried because they couldn't imagine the world without him. And at his funeral, 3 million people pushed themselves into Red Square. Hundreds died in a stampede, were crushed. And that's the kind of that sort of part of that attitude. When you chop wood, chips fly. In death as well as life, the man destroyed people. And to see him being presented now as a Russian patriot should alarm us. I think yesterday somebody told me that Putin made a speech a couple of days ago in which he said that, yes, Stalin had made some mistakes, but who hadn't? And I'm trying to think of how many millions of people I had put on trains and sent to the archipelago. I mean, it's a scary statement when you think about it. The more you think about it, the scarier it gets. Thanks a lot.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodum, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on June 26th, 2007.